So today I'm going to speak about emotion, affection, and friendship, specifically the nature of love. In my first year at Franciscan University of Steubenville, there was a lecture given by a professor from St. Louis University named Eleanor Stump. You may have come across her name. She has a big old book, it's purple, called Aquinas, and then recently she published a big old book called Wandering in Darkness. But she came and she spoke very simply on Aquinas on the nature of love. Now up until that point, I'd gone to public school in CCD, and I have, you know, faithful parents who were very diligent about teaching the faith, but I had what I would describe as a kind of eclectic theology. I knew beautiful things that holy people had said throughout the course of history, but I hadn't quite cobbled together a coherent theory of what that meant. So I knew that, like, St. Irenaeus or St. Athanasius or St. Augustine had something about God becoming man so that man might become God, and I thought that was cool. And I knew something about St. Thomas Aquinas or Aristotle saying something about virtue being in the mean, and I thought that was cool. And, you know, you just kind of extend it down the line. I had a bunch of different discrete thoughts about the faith that I found attractive and compelling, but I had no idea as to how they fit together. I had no idea that theology actually has a kind of coherence, that it's something that's articulated, that it's something that can be expressed kind of propositionally and argumentatively. And then here I am, just kind of bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, walking into a lecture my freshman year, and she begins to explain Aquinas on the nature of love in a way that I found especially excellent. It was really precise, it was really compelling, and I could feel like her trimming the fat off my brain. It was just lean meat, and it was fortifying. And she explained it in such a way that you could see how one thing followed from the next, how it was kind of articulated, or how reality hinged. And by acknowledging at its joints what was in truth of fact the case, it made it easier to diagnose what is, and then by thinking well about it, to love in turn. So I think sometimes we're of the mind, or perhaps of the illusion, that it just matters that you try hard, right? What you think is of secondary importance. It matters that you are sincere, or that you are genuine, or that you give it your best shot. But truth be told, half of the battle is in the mind. Because when you think well about something, it permits you to act well, right? And by seeing the truths of the faith in their context and well articulated, it affords you a deeper entry into the mysteries themselves, which are saving. So Christ saves by the mysteries of his life, as revealed in the scriptures and in the tradition. And ultimately, it's by contact with those things that we are conformed to him and transformed as a result. So I found that what she was describing was especially beautiful, and so I love to talk about love as a result. So what we'll do today is just a basic exposition, not an argument in the strict sense, but a kind of exposition of what St. Thomas understands by love. And some of it will be kind of base, that is to say, something that we share with the beasts, and then we'll talk about the more kind of spiritual dimensions thereof, and then talk specifically about friendship as the highest realization of human love. We won't touch too terribly much on divine love in the sense of charity or in the sense of love as shared among the persons of the Trinity, but we'll kind of gesture in that direction. All right? Now we know that it's classic or classical to describe the differences and the interconnections among love. The differences and interconnections among love. So love, we know, which is one, comes in various and interrelated forms or expressions. So you may have heard of the Greek terminology, which is often trotted out in this instance. So we hear of philia, the love of friendship, which is why Philadelphia is a city of brotherly love. And the Philadelphia Eagles remain world champions for another 3 weeks. Hailing from southeastern Pennsylvania, I say that as a singular boast with a heavy heart. So philia, this kind of sense of platonic love or love of friendship, and then we hear about eros, erotic love or romantic love, and then we hear of agape, which is that peculiarly New Testament term which is used in John to describe divine love, right? Or it at least gestures in that direction. The classic work on this of the 20th century is C.S. Lewis's The Four Loves, which I highly recommend because it's short, he knows the patience of man, and he writes accordingly, and it's also very clear, but not dry. It's kind of impressionistic and very approachable, like you find many of his writings to be. Now, he adds another love, so he goes beyond the scope of just these three, which we heard described. But he describes these different loves in a way that's very beautiful and very helpful. And, just a kind of pro tip, it's also nice to read that book in coordination with Surprised by Joy, which is contemporary with it, which is the story of his conversion, and also with Till We Have Faces, which he thought was his best novel, and which is also contemporary with it, all written in a period of about 3 years, and all of them touched on similar themes. So I think that Till We Have Faces, many people read that because they're like, I read Narnia, and it was beautiful, like, sign me up for more. And then you read the Space Trilogy, and you're like, Space Trilogy, and you're like, wow, that was weird. But kind of cool. And then you're like, what else did he write? And then you find out that there's one more novel, and then you read it, and you're like, I have no idea what just happened. But I'm intrigued. So I would recommend reading it again, and reading it in coordination with The Four Loves and Surprised by Joy. Now, St. Thomas Aquinas has his own distinct terminology. So when he describes love, I'm thinking here specifically of his big book of theology, the Summa Theologiae, he describes it after a different paradigm. He touches on a lot of the same things, but he organizes it differently, and he's actually indebted to a 5th century church father named Pseudo-Dionysius for his arrangement. So first, he describes love just in the sense of, like, attraction, a kind of love that we share with the beasts or with animals. He refers to this in Latin as amor, and for those, you know, who have, you know, French or Spanish, you recognize it as something that you've heard before. Then, when he's describing this love, but with a kind of spiritual resonance to it, or a spiritual dimension, he refers to it as dilexio, again, a word that we recognize from English usage. Then, when he's talking about friendship, it's amicizia. And then when he's talking about divine love, as shared with us in the dispensation of grace, that he calls caritas, or charity. So, what we're going to do is just consider St. Thomas's exposition and his terminology. So first, let's start with amor, with love. Love here is one of what St. Thomas refers to as the passions. I don't have a dry erase marker, but if I did, I would describe things to you with living technicolor. Alas and alack, I'll have to just take a marker and write on my scapular. Just kidding, I won't do that. Okay, so for St. Thomas Aquinas, he has a kind of, I mean, no disrespect, sister. Take that, yeah, okay, perfect. You look slightly censorious. He would never, I won't. Okay, so St. Thomas has a kind of faculty psychology, right? So we are animate, that is to say we have souls, right? So our souls give life to the body. We are one thing composed of body and soul, and we act in and through powers of the soul. Right? So the soul gives expression to our human desires in a variety of ways. So we know that we have these kind of powers that we share with plants, right? So like reproduction, growth, and nutrition. Then we have powers that we share with animals, and this would be what St. Thomas refers to as the passions. And then we have those things which are distinctively human among material creation, namely intellect and will. So we have this big manifold of interacting with reality. So we have all of these different ways in which we can interact with reality. So St. Thomas kind of builds his picture from the bottom up. He doesn't have too terribly much to say about the lowest because they're not habituated in the way that the higher ones are. So we'll just start with the sense appetite. St. Thomas breaks the sense appetite out into a lower kind of simple desires or simple emotions or simple passions, which he calls the concupiscible power, and then the higher ones, which he calls the irascible power. All right, so this is just appetite. This is how appetite is expressed through passions or through emotions. These are things that we share with the beasts. Well, what is love then in the sense of being the bedrock of appetite, in the sense of being a passion? Well, the most basic sense is that love recognizes fittingness. Okay? That's a very simple claim, not especially dramatic, you know, not especially like wild, but we can recognize it as true. Love gives expression to a kind of fittingness, what St. Thomas sometimes calls complacency. So it's a pleasure that is associated with seeing, or with grasping, or with understanding, or apprehending, or cognizing. Something is out there, and then we regard it as somehow addressed to us, as fitting for us, as assimilatable for us. We are made in such a way as to recognize what it is that actually corresponds with our nature. So a kind of longer and more convoluted way of saying this is that because we are what we are, we recognize certain goods out there as for us, especially so. And certain goods remain kind of neutral. You know, like I am more animated at the prospect of a Chick-fil-A sign than I am at the prospect of a Bojangles sign, right? Because there's an objective order of goods in the world, right? with respect to Bojangles fans, okay? I mean, no shade. All right? So before an object that I perceive as good, I love. That's all that I'm really saying. Before an object that I perceive as good for me, I love. Now then, let's talk more about what we mean to say that love is a passion. To say that love is a passion. For those of, you know, like Southern Mediterranean extraction, this is something that resonates. You're like, yes, it is a passion. You know, like, I will now use my hands very expressively. You know, we associate this with, like, Dante. The first circle of hell that he encounters is those of the passionate lovers. And Francesco and, you know, his lady love are, like, tossed about by hot winds. It's like, that's passion. Okay. Now, when St. Thomas describes passion, he doesn't mean it necessarily in this sense, though he was Italian. So for him, passion comes from the Latin patior, which just means I suffer. And not in the sense of, like, I suffer, but in the sense of something is changed in me, right? Something out there impinges upon me in such a way that it alters me, okay? Whether body or soul, I am moved. I am moved in my person. So something, some object of the exterior world touches me and impinges upon me in such a way that I am altered. And the thing about it is that change animates a response in me. Okay? So St. Thomas says this. He describes love as a passion of the sensitive appetite, which by its impulse extends the soul with a kind of violence towards an enticing object. All right? A passion of the sensitive appetite, which by its impulse extends the soul with a kind of violence towards an enticing object. All right? So, when St. Thomas is describing the passions, the bedrock of desire, he has a threefold movement, both with respect to good things and with respect to bad things. So love is the beginning of our response to good things. Love is just the recognition that something out there is addressed to me, that it can move me and touch me. And then, if that thing is not present, and I need move to get it, that begets desire. And then, if the thing is present, or when it is present, that begets pleasure. Okay, so that is the threefold movement with respect to the good for St. Thomas. Just love, desire, and pleasure. And then the flip side with respect to an object perceived as unfitting for me, as evil, right, we then have hatred, aversion, and sorrow. So hatred is just that movement with respect to an object that I perceive as not good for me, right? It just creates a kind of instantaneous impulse away of flight. And then if it's like coming, then I flee, you know, aversion. But if it's something that I cannot avoid, it begets in me a certain sorrow. So that's how St. Thomas understands the emotions, understands the passions. Things out there move me in such a way that I am changed. I am changed, just at the kind of basic level of my sensitive appetite in a way common to both man and beast. Now I'd put it to you, understood in this way, we can appreciate how love creates in one a kind of interior culture, right? So we said that love is this, it's a kind of ecstatic movement, right? It's a recognition of something is fitting, so it's always dialogical. It's always, you know, I and thou in a certain sense. But as a result of which, it changes me. It actually alters my interior states. So I will describe first a trivial example, and then I will describe a more exalted example. So the trivial example. Okay, so recently I was picking up a speaker who was coming into Washington, D.C. For the Thomistic Institute, and there was, you know, catastrophic weather involved, and their plane was rerouted to Norfolk, and then they were circling, and then they had to refuel, and then, like, the pilot and the, you know, staff were, like, at their maximum number of hours, so they had to change them out. Basically, I was at the airport for a long time. Okay. Now, gladly, like Charlotte's airport, DCA is a good airport, which is to say it has a Chick-fil-A. And it's outside of security. Fist pump. Okay, so I went to the Chick-fil-A after like 3 hours, and I got a spicy chicken deluxe. And I got, you know, hold the pickles. Keep them away from me. Okay, and then I got fries, and then I got a cookies and cream milkshake, and I just battened on spoils. Now, here's the thing. They were still not coming anytime soon. So about 2 hours later, I was like, I am weary. And I'm sad. I know what I need. So I went back to Chick-fil-A. Right? And I said, I will have two chocolate chip cookies. Right? But then, like, something magical happened, right? They brought them to me, and this had actually never happened to me before. You know how the Chick-fil-A cookies, they come in, like, a little sleeve with one of those window panes in the front? I noticed that the window pane was slightly fogged, and I was like, oh my gosh, these are fresh baked. It was like 8:47 p.m. at DCA Airport on like a Thursday night, and here I am, twice blessed, all right? Now, just the mere like recognition of that thing created in me like a whole just renovation of my spiritual state. I was like, I was at the brink of like feeling very, very sorry for myself. You know, I was like, I'm at the airport. I could be reading an obscure book alone in my room, you know? And here I am wasting my time in an act of charity, you know? So like, I am very, very close to feeling very, very sorry. And then, as if by, you know, like divine providence, a kind of just the Lord manifesting his love designs for me, his beloved, you know, child, he gives me these window fogging cookies, right? And like all of a sudden, my interior state is completely transformed, okay? That's what love does. Now, that's a trivial example, okay? Now, let's talk about let's talk about a more exalted example, okay? Let's talk about Dante Alighieri and Beatrice Portinari. All right. So Dante, you've heard of this story perhaps. Dante, who is the famous author of the Divine Comedy, he was a Florentine. He wrote at the end of the 13th, beginning of the 14th century. He was very much influenced by Dominican preaching throughout his life. It's not clear whether he took formal study of St. Thomas, but he knew him pretty well. So sometimes the Divine Comedy is referred to as the Summa in Verse. And it's often alleged that it's the greatest Christian, you know, epic poem or poem of its stature, sometimes between him and Milton. Actually, little known fact, strange bit of Catholic archaeology, in the early 20th century, Benedict XV published an encyclical in which Dante is referred to as the greatest poet in all of Christendom. It's like, wow, you just made an encyclical about that. That's awesome. You know, it's like, what else can they write encyclicals about? All right, so, yeah, it's called, like, In Preclaro Sumorum. So, yeah, you might want to check that out if you're doubting me. So, Dante is a young boy at the time. This is, like, in the 1270s. And Beatrice is about his age. They're about 8 or 9 years old. And that's when he met her for the first time. And the thing was, so that meeting was so significant that it, like, entirely changed him as a person. And it's really hard to describe, but I can recount things that he wrote after that meeting and then things that he wrote after their second meeting. They only met twice, in the strict sense. So after having met her the first time, he wrote, Ecce Deus fortior me, qui veniens dominabitur mihi. Behold, a God stronger than I, who coming shall rule over me. So for whatever reason, as a very young man, just the mere sight of this little girl struck him profoundly in such a way that it kind of invaded his consciousness and began to work on him as a man and as a poet. He saw her again at the age of 18, and she greeted him. At their first meeting, she did not, but at their second, he did, and he subsequently refers to her as the Lady of the Salutation. But he was so struck by her greeting that he was unable to respond, literally made dumb. And later that night, he had a dream. And I will just recount to you the way that he describes it in La Vita Nuova. He writes, For there appeared to me in my room a mist of the color of fire, within the which I discerned the figure of a lord of terrible aspect. In his arms, it seemed to me that a person was sleeping, covered only with a crimson cloth, upon whom, looking very attentively, I knew that it was the Lady of the Salutation, who had deigned the day before to greet me. And he who held her held also in his hand a thing that was burning in flames. And he said to me, Behold thy heart. But when he had remained with me a little while, I thought that he set himself to awaken her that slept, after the which he made her to eat that thing which flamed in his hand. And she ate as one fearing. It's incredible. He's seen this person twice. She greeted him once. And the dream is of just unparalleled import. He sees as if a lord appeared to him, clothed in a crimson mist, carrying in his arms the lady whom he loves, and, in his other hand, Dante's own heart, aflame with zeal, which he forces Beatrice to eat as if fearing. So ecstatic is his love that he goes out to her in such a way as to be consumed, and he is consumed in turn. The love is so significant that it changes him forever. Now, mind you, Beatrice died at a young age. She died at, like, the age of 24 or 25. And Dante married. He married Gemma Donati, and they had children, and they had a tolerably happy existence until such time as Dante was exiled from Florence, and then he just railed against the fact for the rest of his life. But this meeting with Beatrice changed everything. It changed his life. It also changed poetry. La Vita Nuova, the new life to which he refers, actually inspires a whole new poetic movement. It's the beginning of the sweet new style, which is, I mean, the height of poetry in Europe and Christendom at the time. It also changes Italy as a country. I mean, at this point, it doesn't exist. It doesn't exist until the 19th century in the strict sense. But the reason that Italians speak the Italian that they do is because they speak effectively a Florentine dialect. The reason for which is because Dante wrote in it and because St. Catherine of Siena wrote in it. So the highest expression of their mother tongue is in this region, as a result of which it spreads to the whole land. So too, it affects the whole trajectory of Christendom. This is a signal moment. This is hugely formative for them culturally as a people, because just a generation later, the Black Death will kill almost half of Europe. And at that point, they have to cling to their cultural riches which remain. And this is one of them. This is the one of the most significant. So, and I mean, like, this changed me. I had a class in college on the Divine Comedy, taught by a man who is incredible and inimitable, so I will not try, Professor Benjamin Alexander. He had actually done his PhD in African-American literature, so he was constantly drawing comparisons between Dante and Langston Hughes. I was like, yeah, that's awesome. And this particular class had a very profound effect on me. Like, previously, I had, like, sworn off reading because I thought that all literature was just mired in, like, post-structuralist or, like, Marxist critiques. People weren't, like, for whatever reason, where I went to school, this is not Steubenville, they just weren't interested in what a thing said. They were interested in the kind of advocacy that could be drawn from a text, and I just found that kind of exhausting. So I was like, I know what I'll do. I'll be a math major and speak in numbers and, like, swear off words. But then, like, I was forced to take a couple of humanities classes, and all of a sudden I'm just like, wow, 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 gaga, 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 gaga. You know? It's just like something is afoot here for which I cannot account. And now I'm just like a nerd by profession. So it changed my life. So we speak to a trivial example and then a more exalted example, but we see how love has this kind of interior dimension of change, of transformation, of renovation. It creates an interior culture. And this leads us, somewhat seamlessly, into the higher dimensions of love. We've already really touched on it, but now we're going to describe it more so properly. So love has properly spiritual resonance or properly spiritual dimensions. And so St. Thomas will here describe it as dilexio. So basically, what we describe formally is something principally associated with the sense appetite. And now we're describing a love that is a matter of knowing and of volition, you know, so of intellect and of will. And the way that St. Thomas usually describes this is in terms of love of concupiscence and love of friendship. So love of concupiscence and love of friendship as two dimensions present in every act of love. Now, the language here is a kind of stumbling block, so we're going to take what, you know, measures need be taken in order to clarify. So here we go. I'm just going to read you a text from St. Thomas, and then we're going to unpack it. He writes, "The movement of love has a twofold tendency, towards the good, that is the thing, which a man wishes to someone, whether to himself or to another, and, secondly, towards him to whom he wishes the good. Accordingly, man has love of concupiscence towards the good that he wishes to another, and love of friendship towards him to whom he wishes the good." Okay, let's unpack that. He has love of concupiscence with respect to the good thing, and then love of friendship with respect to the person that that good thing is willed for or unto. So for St. Thomas, love regards two things. It regards a good, first and primarily. And then, as a subsequent movement, not necessarily in time, but logically, it regards another. Now, here's the thing. That other can actually be yourself. So, like, the kind of ongoing love affair that I have with Chick-fil-A chocolate chip cookies is a kind of love, but it's love unto me. So I have love of concupiscence with respect to the cookie, and then that redounds to me in the movement of love of friendship, because I will a good for a person. Now, that doesn't mean that it is a selfish love. Right? We recognize a place in the cosmos for the loving of cookies, right? Provided that it doesn't become an idol, it is to be affirmed, right? We celebrate that fact. We do. Right? So to say that love of concupiscence regards the good and love of friendship in this instance regards the person doesn't mean that it's selfish, okay? It doesn't mean that it's selfish. And we can't be tripped up by the language of concupiscence here. We associate that with the most vehement effect of original sin, right? But concupiscence just comes from the Latin concupiscere, which just means to desire. All right, so it's that element of love, that desirous element of love that regards the good. And then love of friendship is that element of love which regards the person. Okay. So, love of friendship, I should say before moving on, that love of friendship can also regard another person. That love of friendship can also regard another person. So, like, when I will something for another, in the sense of, you know, like, when I cook dinner in my community and then provision my brothers with, you know, dinner, that's, I'm willing a good, namely the good of sustenance, of bodily sustenance through this food for them. So here's the good thing, food. Here's the other, namely the community. So love of concupiscence towards the good and love of friendship towards the person for whom it is willed. So love of friendship is love in the strict sense, right? That's love, that gives most adequate expression to love. And then love of concupiscence is love kind of after a manner of speaking. So St. Thomas would say secundum quid, according to a certain sense, but not simply, okay? So it is literally loved for another. So we don't terminate our love in the good. It terminates in another person. So ultimately, it finds the horizon of its homing in someone, okay? So it's something to be shared among subjects. So just then, a couple of explanatory things about love of concupiscence and love of friendship. Love of concupiscence bears on something insufficient for completing love, right? So it doesn't actually give rest to the movement of love because it's reached as the good of another, whether of myself or of another acting subject. So you kind of move towards that good, but ultimately in a way that it actually comes home. It experiences or comes to a kind of rest in another person. So St. Thomas says something like, I love bread and wine, not in themselves, but for eating and drinking. That is to say, for me, for the subject for whom they are loved. So, like, it wouldn't make sense, you know, in your house to have, like, a kind of trophy case of beautiful foods, right? You're like, let's say you go to the supermarket, you know, you go to the Aldi, and you get, like, a cut of London broil, and you're just admiring, like, the butcher's cut. You know, he's got that, like, bandsaw circulating thing going on, and he's like, and then he gets it, and you're like, wow, that is a beautifully cut piece of meat. I will now frame it. You know, it's like, that's, like, not our tendency, right? We don't think about it as a kind of thing unto itself. You know, we love it as comestible, as nourishing, as delicious, as potentially delivering an incredible amount of A1 sauce to my gullet, you know? So we don't stop there. We stop in the person. Now, this is by comparison to love of friendship, okay? So love of friendship actually bears on someone sufficient for completing the love. So love can actually terminate in persons, right? So love of friendship does not refer love further because the one who is loved is good in himself. The one who is loved is good in himself. So then, with love of friendship, the relation is actually to the subject for whom the good is loved, even if the subject is myself. Now here, basically, much of the point of drawing this distinction is to banish a false sense. Okay? So oftentimes, when people hear about love of concupiscence and love of friendship, they draw a false dichotomy. They say love of concupiscence is selfish, and love of friendship is altruistic. Selfishness, therefore, spurnworthy, altruistic, and therefore good. What we're saying here is not that. What we are saying, in fact, is that both dimensions are present in every act of loving. Okay? So it's not so much a division of love as it is things, or no, it's not so much a division of love but it is of the way that our love bears on different parts of that exchange, or different dimensions that are entailed in an act of love. In truth, they are always found together. So this is from Cardinal Cajetan. For one and the same love is love of friendship with respect to the friend, and love of concupiscence with respect to the good willed to him. So here, a hugely, hugely important thing to keep in mind is that love is ultimately about communion in the good. Okay? Love is ultimately about communion in the good. Why do I bring this up? So I think C.S. Lewis kind of gestures towards it in the Four Loves. He's trying to characterize, well, he's got a kind of like British sensibility to him, so he's naturally like a little bit nervous about erotic love, right, with respect to those in the audience who are British. But as a result of which, he like spends a lot of time on friendship, and erotic love kind of suffers by comparison, right? So we're in a kind of dispensation that does not have those hang-ups. But it is fascinating to note. And one of the comparisons that he draws is he says erotic love tends to have a kind of face-to-face quality, whereas he says with friendship, it's more so that the persons are side-to-side, that they're focused on some one thing, some common good, and as a result of which, it begets a kind of union in action. Okay? Now, I do not think that it is necessarily entailed in erotic love that it's like overly involved in the other, or it's necessarily entailed in friendship that it's good regarding. But I think that that comparison is helpful for alerting us to the fact that there is always a good present in love. Okay? So it's not sufficient that you have the other person and that the other person has you. And I think a lot of people have had this experience. Like, say perhaps you had a relationship, and initially it was going well, right? You found that you had common interests, and you delighted in them. And you found that the conversation and the enjoyment kind of flowed seamlessly. But at a certain time, one becomes exceedingly sensitive to the other person. Maybe there's kind of like occult sensitivities that you didn't know previously existed. Or maybe there's like some kind of trauma or sadness that's getting worked out. But as a result of which, maybe like one or the other person becomes so more so like brooding or more so reserved. And as a result of which, the other person tries to get more involved in their interior states. They're like taking the other person's temperature all the time and trying to assess whether or not they're good and things are good. And then that relationship becomes more so bound up with what the other people are thinking and feeling. And then the love is gone. It's very fascinating how that can happen. Because there's no longer a common good towards which both proceed. Rather, they're focused on each other, and they come to discover that what united them formerly is no longer present. Because you are not sufficient to save me, and I am not sufficient to save you. Rather, we are saved by something that goes before us. So again, to speak in a more like theological register, think about this with respect to how St. Thomas describes peace. In the Treatise on Charity, which is in the second part of the second part, it's like questions 23 to 46, it's pretty meaty, okay? So St. Thomas describes charity in se, and then he describes three interior dimensions of charity: peace, joy, and mercy. Those questions are short and they're awesome, okay? So when he describes peace, he basically says that interior peace results from a kind of exterior peace, or that is to say, like microcosmic peace happens as a result of macrocosmic peace. So a helpful illustration is this. Picture a time during which, like, okay, so picture a flotilla of ships, an armada, okay? A gaggle. That's not a proper term. Okay, so picture a bunch of ships together. Now, let's say they don't have navigational instruments, and let's say they can't read the stars, and let's say that, like, all technology has been reversed, and we're, like, in a relative sailing stone age. Okay. How do they proceed towards their goal? How do they proceed towards their goal? Well, they could make adjustments based on the position of other ships in the flotilla. Right? If you got thus and such close to me, then I'd back off. But here's the thing. You're in a big old flotilla, so when you make an adjustment based off him, then you fall afoul of whatever, the limiter boundary with respect to another. So you're constantly having to do this. You're constantly having to rearrange your life and that of others based on the flux that is just characterizes the group. But what if all of those ships picked a point on the horizon and proceeded together and proceeded at pace? Yeah, you'd have to make adjustments, undoubtedly. But everyone is proceeding in the same vector, and as a result of which, it tends to organize the relationships among the constituent parts. So too, St. Thomas is suggesting, with respect to love. What is of primary import is the good that one regards. Now, mind you, we said that love of friendship takes pride of place, not as a love that's better than love of concupiscence, because we said that both dimensions are always present in every act. So love of friendship is primary in that it actually terminates in the person. It actually regards another. But the good is that in which you have communion with the other. That's actually where you find common ground. That's where you find common enjoyment. That's where you find common delight. So it matters what kind of goods you have communion in. So, like, you can be friends with somebody because, like, you go into your parents' basement and play Fortnite for 7 hours together, and they don't talk too much, which is, like, makes them tolerable, you know? But the question is that the most exalted good? Okay? Now, I'm not saying here that, like, we need prefer the most exalted good with all of our friends at all times. You know, like, your friend's like, hey, you want to get some ice cream? And you're like, I'd prefer that we be in adoration right now. You know, it's like, okay, easy. just talking about ice cream here, you know? Just ice cream, right? So I'm not saying that, like, we're not talking about good maximalism, right? But we are talking about a kind of, like, coherent life ordered towards goods that are properly human and that will only attain peace in our friendships when those goods are ordered and that we are ordered in response to them, in communion with them. And this, I mean, ultimately, this comes home in our relationship with God. We'll only be at peace with those around us when we are at peace with God. Otherwise, we will be constantly accusing those with whom we live of our own insufficiencies because we have not yet been reconciled. You think about that with respect to, like, John 17, that they may be one as we are one. We think about that a lot in the post-16th century dispensation as, like, ecumenism. We need to, like, order our relationships with others. But that particular phrase is interpreted in the history of the church for 1,500 years as principally about salvation. It's principally soteriological. That they may be one as we are one. That is to say that they may be reconciled to us and enjoy a kind of wholeness as a result of having had their sins forgiven, having been cleansed, having been fortified by grace and virtue and the gifts of the Holy Spirit. And then we can hope for communion interpersonally. But it only comes as a result of this, of communion in the good. And if we think that we can, you know, buy peace at another cost, we are self-deceived. It will not be lasting. So, the whole point, again, of kind of adducing this comparison between love of concupiscence and love of friendship is to put a certain emphasis on communion in the good, which terminates in persons, but is about the good. Okay. So that's our second of 3 points. And for our third and final, we'll just take some Thomistic, impressionistic thoughts about friendship. So this is really where we see love come to fruition, where we see love come to its most excellent expression. So friendship is just a rational love shared between two persons, okay? It's just a rational love shared between two persons. So, right, love is often described as mutual benevolence with communion. So there are three dimensions operative in love. It's benevolent or beneficent. So benevolent, benevolent, like just to will the good of the other, or beneficent, to do the good of the other, because every wish, every aspiration is ultimately, you know, it comes to expression in concrete deeds. That's the whole, like, faith works thing. So, benevolence, and then it's shared. That is to say, it's mutual. Because if you love someone and they don't, you know, reciprocate that, then it's not real friendship, right? And then it has to have a certain shared life. So, cum communicatione, he says, like, with communication, with communion, with discourse, with intercourse of a sort. So, we can also describe it as the union of, or like the kind of combination of two desires. It's the desire for the good of the beloved and desire for union with the beloved. So I desire the good of the beloved and I desire union with the beloved. So the two are held together. Josef Pieper, who's a 20th century Thomistic commenter or commentator, he says, when the true lover says, it is good that you exist, he wants to be one with the person he loves, right? It is good that you exist. It's a kind of affirmation. It's a kind of desire for the good thereof. And he wants to dwell with that person. Now, often classically, we have three forms of friendship described for us in, like, Aristotle and in St. Thomas's comments thereupon. So he describes these three friendships depending on the good around which they congregate or around which they are united. So there's what he calls friendship of use, and then friendship of pleasure, and then what is sometimes called, like, noble friendship or honest friendship or virtuous friendship. The word in Latin is honestum. The word in Greek is cologne, which is, like, infamously hard to describe or hard to translate, right? So it's, like, noble friendship or beautiful friendship. It's just, you don't have the words for it because, well, you just don't have the words for it, okay? So Friendship of use is easy to describe in the sense that you're united around a good that is useful to you. So I have a kind of friendship of use with the cashier at the Chick-fil-A, right? So I come and they say, what would you like? You're welcome to Chick-fil-A, what would you like? And I say, spicy chicken deluxe meal. And then I afford them time to plug that in. And then I wait for them to ask the next question. What would you like to drink? And then I say, I would like a cookies and cream milkshake, a large, because that's going to be your next question. And then they're going to ask me about sauces. And I'm like, I would like 2 Chick-fil-A sauces. Please put them in that little cute thing that I put on my table. And then they do. And then they're like, it's this much. And then I give them that much. And then I leave. All right? And then they tell me it's their pleasure. And I think, yeah, it is. And it's my pleasure, too. You're a champion. And then I go to my seat, and they bring me my food within like 2.5 minutes because it's Chick-fil-A, and those places are awesome. Okay. Sorry, I just get kind of ebullient the closer I get to Atlanta. You know, it's just like, I feel it. It's just like, oh my gosh. All right, so that's a kind of friendship of use. I don't call those people up on the weekends, and that's fine, right? You don't have to have maximal friendship with everyone you meet. Otherwise, your brain would explode, right? Like, we can only have meaningful connections with so many people in our lives, and that's fine. That's totally good. So just to say that it's a friendship of use doesn't mean that I'm, like, diminishing that person. It doesn't mean that I am using them in the negative sense. It just means it's the good under consideration is just a kind of usefulness, right? So like a friendship of pleasure. I live in the Northeast, right? And there are a lot of hipsters in the Northeast, right? So they wear like nice pants and nice shoes and have like interesting facial hair and nice haircuts. And then they're like, those hipsters in Brooklyn like to play croquet. It's very fascinating. They do it all ironically, you know, kind of like sneering while playing croquet. Right? So, like, people will congregate for the express purpose of playing croquet together, right? And they share their ironic jokes. They talk about the most recent, like, David Foster Wallace book that they've read. And then they talk about, like, where they're going to get deals, you know, on, like, hipster retro clothing. And then they disperse. Does that make them bad people? That they're not more interested in each other's spiritual fate? No. That's, like, a perfectly acceptable reason for which to congregate. Because croquet is delightful, right? Because it's one of those sports that everyone's bad at. Right? And it's good that those sports exist because then you resent athletic people less. You know, it's just like, let's all go here and then make a hash out of this thing and then leave. And that's like kind of delightful. The most recent croquet game that I played was with a family in the parish where I was last assigned. And there was like, they have 6 girls and they destroyed me at croquet. I was like, gosh, man. Then like, they're like 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, and 12. And I was just like, okay, so croquet, right? So you come together for something that's delightful, pleasant, just playing croquet on a Brooklyn afternoon. So it doesn't mean that it's bad, just that it serves its particular purpose. So then the last is this kind of good or noble or virtuous or honest, beautiful friendship. And this is the friendship that congregates around highest goods, right? So communion in what is most truly human, what is actually constitutive of us as persons. And I would actually put it to you that the quality of life is often determined by how many of these or how deep these types of friendship are in your life. So especially nowadays, it's really hard to make friends because there's like a lot of false connectivity. I don't know anything about social media, so I don't even know how to describe it. I don't even know like the right like articles to use, like the or N Facebook. Actually, I don't know. So I'm not going to say anything about that because I don't know anything about that. But I do think that there's a lot of like the cultivating of false image and false connectivity that results with that. So there's the appearance of friendship, but it all operates on a kind of superficial plane, as a result of which it's harder to establish deep and abiding connections among persons. And this can be exceedingly difficult, and it can be really sorrowful. So this love is what ends up being most distinctive about us as humans. And again, to return to our point about love of concupiscence and love of friendship, I am not saying that this love is just about altruism. It's not. It's not just like, those are those best friendships where you show yourself most heroically generous and expect nothing in return. You know? Like, there's an episode of The Office where, like, Andy Bernard, whenever he receives a gift, he has to, like, outdo them with a better gift in return. Like, that's not friendship. That's madness, right? So I'm not saying that you have to, like, everyone has to constantly be in your debt because you will always leap up and do the dishes before anyone even thinks about it, like as a way to both be generous and to shame them. You know, it's like, no, that's not what I'm talking about. It's actually what's decisive is the good in which you both revel, the kind of things for which you come together. I was like, I had a group of friends in college, and initially we came together, we studied abroad in Austria, and there was a stream that ran in front of the place where we live, which was actually a 14th century Carthusian monastery. It was devastatingly beautiful. And we go out our front door every day at 7 a.m., and we jump in a stream while saying, penance, penance, penance for poor sinners, quoting Our Lady of Lourdes. And we had a communion in the good of bodily penance. Now, mind you, was there a lot of tomfoolery? Was there a lot of guffaw? You better believe it. Was it, like, spiritually mature? Probably not. Was it a ton of fun? Yes. Yeah, it was. Right? But we went about something for the purpose of, you know, like, the good. Because we found it attractive, seductive, delightful, and rich. And that formed a friendship among us, which perdures, you know, 10 years after the fact. Which is really cool. Because we congregated around something meaningful and life-giving. Namely, the Lord, and what he offers in the life of grace. So, this is not mere altruism. It's about the good. And what happens, in truth of fact, is that altruism gives way. It actually gives way in the sense that there ceases to be the same kind of distinction between you and the other. Right? So, like, in justice, there's this pretty stark insistence that I am me, and you are not. And in a certain sense, like, never the twain shall meet. There's this sense of clear distinction. I render to you the debt which I owe you, and I do that in a sense of strict justice. But charity, it contains justice virtually, but it goes beyond it. And as a result of which, there is not so much an insistence upon, like, my rights and yours and the honoring thereof. Now, that doesn't say that, like, you permit yourself to be victimized in an otherwise abusive relationship, but it does mean that you don't insist so much on, like, I'm going to watch out for myself and I'm going to get mine, to quote Julius Campbell from Remember the Titans, right? It's that I actually begin to will the other's good as my own. I begin to will the other's good as my own because it is. And we can actually share it in common. It can actually pertain to both of us in a way that's mutually enriching and doesn't represent a loss or a debit in my column because it's a credit in yours. It's not like all resources are scarce. And if you attain to great heights, then I suffer by comparison and wither away in jealousy. But it's actually learning to love what is good together and to proceed apace. Okay, so this is like where we kind of get into those descriptions of how a friend is another self. So in friendship, there's this kind of revelation. It's a kind of manifestation that here is one like unto me. Here is one like unto me. This person is not so much fitting for assimilation as they are for communion. You know, this is not someone to consume. This is someone in whom to delight and with whom to delight. So a friend, as Aristotle says, is another self. That is to say, they're not an extension of my egotistical self. Rather, I lose myself in the good of another as my own good. I rejoice in the good of another as my own good. And I would put it to you that what we find paradoxically is that this actually increases our capacity for love and for desire and for happiness. So, like, in the Divine Comedy, in the Purgatorio, there's this one point at which a soul from a lower circle of purgatory is loosed, and they're sent up to heaven, right? They have purged themselves, or they have been purged, of those, you know, faults and stains which kept them from the vision of God, and now they are moving up the mountain. And the souls and the higher grades, they turn to that soul and welcome it, and they say, here comes one who will augment my love. Here comes one who will grow my love. A passage that I love, I don't know if anyone's ever read G.K. Chesterton's The Man Who Was Thursday. That's another book that's up there with Till We Have Faces. The first time you read it, you're like, yeah. Like, what just happened? You know, it's kind of like deer in the headlights. You, like, look around in your living room, like, is anyone else as confused as I am? And then you realize you're alone. Okay. So, in this story, the protagonist is Gabriel Syme, or Gabriel Sim, however you pronounce it. And he's a policeman, and he infiltrates the High Anarchical Council of Europe. I don't remember the exact name. But he's in there with a bunch of anarchists and communists and bomb throwers, like a very malign and shady bunch. And he's undercover, effectively, to find out who's the head, namely Thursday, and to undermine him, you know, to bring him in. And meanwhile, he thinks that all these other men are anarchists, like through and through, dyed in the wool. But what he comes to discover is that one by one, I'm going to ruin it, they're also all undercover policemen. They're all detectives, okay? And when he discovers this first, that when he discovers that one of his colleagues is in truth, in fact, a policeman, he says this. Through all this ordeal, his root horror had been isolation. And there are no words to express the abyss between isolation and having one ally. It may be conceded to the mathematicians that 4 is twice 2, but 2 is not twice 1. 2 is 2,000 times 1. think about it. Now I'm going to read it again. Through all this ordeal, his root horror had been isolation. And there are no words to express the abyss between isolation and having one ally. It may be conceded to the mathematicians that 4 is twice 2, but 2 is not twice 1. 2 is 2,000 times 1. So on the one hand, this is Chesterton being classically paradoxical. He will subvert his prose for 3 straight pages just to make a pun. I respect that about him. Right? I wish I had an imagination like unto his. But what he is effectively saying is that it's like the difference between not having a friend and having a friend isn't like the difference of being like tolerably happy to being a little bit more tolerably happy. It's the difference between being like terrified and like finding it possible to live. Right? So a friend doesn't just like double your efficiency or effectiveness or enjoyment of life. It's a force multiplier that doesn't actually like abide by mathematical rules. The difference between not having a friend and having a friend is the difference between like, you know, like jumping in front of the train and getting on the train. You know, it is marked. It is stark. C.S. Lewis in The Four Loves describes the kind of feeling that one has or the experience that one has of having a group of 3 friends, okay? Say 3 very long, very, you know, just like intimate friends who have enjoyed many experiences and in life in a very profound way together. And then he says, envision if one of them dies, okay? He says, you might think that those 2 people who remain would then have more of each other. They would be able to experience their friendship in the absence of this other person in a way that would somehow go beyond what had formerly been the case. But he says it's just the reverse that is true. Because there are things in the first person's personality and in the second person's personality that only that third person could draw out. Because friends, in a certain sense, coax the good out of each other. They make us better. They make us want to be better. They make us, like, want to love, and they give us a capacity for it. And they also increase our capacity to enjoy life. So far from having more of that next person, I have less of him, because there are things that only the third person could draw out, which is cool. So, just by way of conclusion, perhaps the most beautiful thing or the most true thing that one could say of friendship is that it makes life possible. And I know that sounds like a kind of modest claim, but it's true, and it's terra firma, it's solid ground. Because as Aristotle remarks at the beginning of the Nicomachean Ethics, or at the end thereof, without friends, who could live? So thank you for your attention. So we have an opportunity for a couple of questions, if anyone would like to venture them. Feel no pressure.
Father, can you venture more on the common good? What are some characteristics of the common good?
Sure. Right. So what is the common good? This will sound dry and uninteresting for about 80 seconds, and then it'll get pretty sweet. All right, so there are a variety of ways in which to describe the good. But for the most part, what we often think about when we think about goods are particular goods, okay? So a particular good is that when one person has it, another person doesn't. Or when one person takes from it, it's somehow diminished, okay? So think about like a reservoir or like a jar of candy or like a pension fund. So we speak about them as if they were common goods because many people draw from them, right? But they aren't common goods in the strict sense because when I take from those things, I diminish them, I deplete them. So it's only common in the sense that all of us have access to it. But when I drink water, I diminish the reservoir. When I take candy, I diminish the candy jar. And when I take from the pension fund, I diminish the pension fund. So strictly speaking, it's a particular good that's shared among many. What is true about common goods? Well, common goods are transcendent in the sense that I can enjoy it and not diminish it. I can enjoy it and not diminish it. And actually, when more enjoy it, it is increased, redoubled. It's actually augmented. So St. Thomas describes 3 different types of wholes. The most important one is the third one. So like a substantial whole. And in this case, the form of the thing makes it just to be what it is. So like the soul of the body makes it to be a human person, right? So if you break that up, you don't actually have what remains. Like you have nothing. So like if you separate body from soul, you don't have a body and a soul. You have a soul and a corpse. So it's just a substantial whole is this, you know, the form makes it to be what it is. And then you have a kind of accidental whole. So this would be like a chocolate bar, right? The form of the thing just makes it to be what it is, but it can always be broken apart into smaller and smaller pieces. Okay? So that form can effectively be divided. Third and finally, you have what is called a whole of order. Okay? A whole of order. And actually, the wholeness makes all things pertain to some order in common. Okay? So it's common to speak about, like, in the Catholic social teaching of three great societies, right? So there's the family, the church, and the polity. Each of those have two common goods. There's an intrinsic common good, right, which is just the order of the parts. And then there's the extrinsic common good, which is the common good for which that thing is ordained. All right? The problem is that you can't cash out on common goods, right? So, like, in the case of a marriage and family, if a man and a woman decide to divorce and separate, you don't get to leave with 50% of the marriage, right? We speak about the bond being dissolved. It exists no more. So you can't take, you know, 50% of connubial bliss and then your spouse takes 50% with him. Rather, everyone loses and the good is diminished and the good actually evaporates because you no longer have the interior ordering of the family. There's no longer the bond that once was, and there's no longer the same kind of vital connection between spouses and children, which makes a domestic church. So the intrinsic common good is the order, all right, which has a kind of transcendent purpose, and then the extrinsic common good is that higher thing for which it is ordained. So in the case of the family, it's actually ordained to the next greater society, to the polity, right? Because the family comes to perfect expression in the state, not in like the 19th, 20th century sense of state, but in the sense of like the polis, the city, right? And so too, ultimately, when you go up to more and more common goods, eventually you get to God, who is the common good of the entire universe, who is transcendent to the utmost extent. So all of us can enjoy God and in no wise diminish him, right? Because it's an immaterial good for one, and because, you know, we are infinitely capacious, God is infinitely generous, and charity is infinite, so, like, party on. So that is something in which we derive greater enjoyment in the context of communion, right? So, like, we rejoice in the sufferings of the martyrs, or we rejoice in the missionary efforts of, you know, 16th and 17th century Jesuits, right? Because this all somehow pertains immediately to our spiritual good, which is bound up in God. Then the intrinsic common good of the church is its order. We can speak about it as like the mystical body, right? And if the eye suffers, the foot suffers. We know that, and we know that especially acutely since like August, for instance, right? But when there are glories to be celebrated, we all rejoice in the victories of the church, you know, like we all rejoice in its triumphs. So yes, a common good is transcendent. It's individual. It's indivisible. It admits of no diminishment, and it's both intrinsic and then extrinsic. So, and the intrinsic being ordered to the extrinsic. And I think that's a good way to organize our thoughts about friendship, because ultimately it's ordered towards a common good. Because when you lose a friendship, you don't get half of it. You don't get anything. You just get sorrow and pain. All right, and subsequent contrition, and please God, a brighter future, because He only permits evil to happen if He wants to bring about from it a greater good. So, yes.
What is the difference between an in-depth love and a friendship? How do you discern the difference?
I didn't actually hear the qualifier for the first type of love. Did you say inept?
In-depth.
In-depth. Okay. In-depth love and friendship. So I guess, like, love doesn't necessarily entail mutuality. It doesn't necessarily entail reciprocation. Because if that were the case, then I'd have, like, a real difficulty loving my neighbor. Right? Because I'm sure there are people that hate me. And if I couldn't love them, then I would have great difficulty fulfilling, you know, the new commandment. But we see the pattern, you know, is made gloriously manifest for us by Christ on the cross, who forgives his persecutors even as they are killing him. So love entails willing the good of the beloved and willing union with the beloved to the extent that it's possible. So Eleanor Stump talks about there being different offices of love. Saint Augustine would classically speak about an order of charity or an order of love. So there are persons that pertain most immediately to your good, and we are responsible for loving them most. So we're responsible for loving God most, and then ourselves next, and then our neighbors next most, and then our own bodies, and then our neighbors' bodies. You know, like Saint Augustine goes through this whole thing. But I can't rely upon the other to reciprocate that love, and yet it is still possible to love them in a way that's not haughty or condescending or necessarily entails me, like, keeping tab, so that I can get paid back. You know, this is like strict gospel. It's like, don't invite those who can repay you. Rather, go into the highways and byways and bring in those who are poor and sick and etc. So love just means willing the good of the beloved and then willing union with them. The most kind of like baseline sense of that, like how do I love people in Sri Lanka? I want them to know and love and serve God and to enjoy him in the next, right? And I want to enjoy union with them in the beatific vision. I want to see all things in the Word and to revel in that for all eternity, and I want them to be there with me. Because there are certain notes in the heavenly choir that only they can provide. And there are certain things in that glorious strain which will be, in a certain sense, lost unless they are brought there together, right? So I want that for them. And part of my vocation is as a kind of universal offering such that they be there in turn. But I don't, you know, like I don't write them letters. I don't, like, send them emails. I don't even send them care packages, you know? I haven't, you know, like, fulfilled the evangelical mandate of proclaiming to them the wonders of Chick-fil-A, you know? Like, perhaps that's a deficiency, but because they don't pertain immediately to my life and good, you know, like, I don't kind of, like, worry about that too terribly much. But then there are people that, like, over whom I have care of souls. You know, there are people with whom I live. There's myself. There's my family, right? So I need to love those with whom I'm thrown together as best I can, even if they can't reciprocate it. So that'd be like an in-depth love. And then friendship means that it's actually returned, right? And I think that friendship is part of human flourishing. I mean, like, friendship with Christ, preeminently and principally. And it's possible to subsist on that, but that takes kind of heroic graces afforded to, like, hermits and saints who are castivated by their own community, you know, like John of the Cross or such like. So, yes. So thanks for your questions. And feel free, if you have any more questions, feel free. I'll just be hanging out here, and I'm delighted to answer them. But also feel free to enjoy the rest of your evening. So thank you for your time.